Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is Terry Patton, the creator and host of Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. And for those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice, the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. This series was convened to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a probing, ongoing public dialogue about how liberating consciousness, how higher levels, higher breadths of consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current challenges and make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. This is broadcast in a whole series of conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I will be joined by Peter Levine, and we'll continue that discussion in a conversation we've entitled Creating Health in a Traumatized Society. The way this will work is I'll introduce Peter and we'll spend about an hour having a real conversation, not just a series of monologues, a real investigation, and then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about half an hour taking your questions and we'll finish up in about 90 minutes or a little longer. Peter Levine is the originator of somatic experiencing, the increasingly influential, neurologically attuned approach to healing trauma that he began developing 40 years ago. In recognition of his pioneering work, he received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the United States Association for Body Psychotherapy. He served as a stress consultant for NASA during the early days of space shuttle development, and he served on the American Psychological Association Task Force for responding to large-scale disasters and ethno-political warfare. He's the author of several best-selling books on trauma, including Waking the Tiger, Healing Trauma, published in 24 languages, and his most recent book, In an Unspoken Voice, How the Body Releases Trauma and Restores Goodness. There are now thousands of somatic experiencing practitioners helping people with trauma all over the world. What I especially appreciate about Peter's work that, in my way of viewing it, it's really critical to what could be thought of as the third wave of psychotherapy. Loosely speaking, the first wave of psychotherapy had to do with insight, with shining the light of awareness on psychological patterns and liberating an ability to respond. And that was really having to do, that insight, with the cortical regions of our brain. Then there was a second wave of psychotherapy, loosely speaking, that really paid a lot of attention to the limbic brain, and that is to having real emotional corrective experiences. This would include a lot of the first wave of body-centered psychotherapy, where tears and actual corrective emotional experiences really became more primary just than insight. But now there's really a third wave that gets down to the brain stem, to the fundamental activation, arousal, shutdown, freeze, the patterns in the brainstem that are prior to our insight and cognition. And I think Peter's been a seminal figure in bringing that awareness forward and changing the whole field of psychotherapy with that awareness. So I'm really honored to have you with us today, Peter. Welcome.
Thank you, Terry. I actually enjoyed your introduction, your preface. I think it's quite accurate about the different waves of psychology. And the one thing I would add to the third wave is that I hope the third wave is a lot about embodiment. It's about the brainstem. It's about our basic survival responses, but it's really how we embody all of our experience, whether it's sensation, emotion, affect, or insight, understanding, comprehension.
Would you like to elaborate a little more on that? I had a different way of beginning this in mind, but I actually think this is pretty interesting. So this matter of embodiment, I was going to begin with a discussion of trauma, but in a way, perhaps perhaps this conversation about embodiment might be a different way in that, that might be quite revealing.
Well, we can go in either direction. I mean, I think hopefully we'll return to embodiment no matter what where we start.
Well, then why don't we begin with just creating a groundwork for everyone to have a common understanding of what we're even talking about when we use the word. Would you tell us, just in a basic way, what is trauma?
Yeah. Okay. What is trauma? That's probably the most difficult question to try to answer. We have, of course, the definition of trauma in the DSM. That's the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. It's the manual that psychologists and psychiatrists use to diagnose their patients and to bill insurance companies. And trauma, as PTSD, became defined by the memories, the haunting memories that happened to people. And see, this was at the as people return, and soldiers return from the Vietnam War, who were very, very injured, not just physically, but psychologically, emotionally, spiritually. And these people were diagnosed frequently as being schizophrenic because they were hallucinating, they were having flashbacks, or as being personality disorders, so that the military wouldn't have to pay for their disability, that these were pre-existing conditions. And so a group of very, very courageous people during that time really changed the course of diagnosis of trauma. But again, this was really about memories, about flashbacks. But more fundamentally, getting back to embodiment, trauma is something that happens in our body, in our bodies. When we are overwhelmed, when we are shocked, when we are threatened, we respond in one or two ways. Either we mobilize for fight and flight, this is the sympathetic adrenal system, or when we experience mortal threat, when we experience that this is the end of our life, and it could be from an external event or it could be something that's going on internally. So if we're injured or we're sick, our bodies shut down. They conserve energy. And instead of feeling overwhelmed, we feel nothing, or we feel numbness. And when a person is traumatized, they're under the oppression of one or both of these responses. And so this is important to see, because when you help somebody heal, when you help somebody resolve their trauma experience, it's important to know where they're stuck. And this has been a very important thing that has been neglected in much of the trauma treatment. So again, there are really two, there's a spectrum of trauma. And the spectrum of trauma runs all the way from things that have happened to us as children, times that we've been betrayed or abandoned, that linger with us. And people in therapy are often astonished how a seemingly simple incident has had the effect. I'll give you one example. A child had seen a magician pull a tablecloth away from a table and leaving everything on the table. So, of course, she tried that at home. And when she was about 5 years old, and she pulled the tablecloth, and of course everything went crashing to the ground. Well, she had a phobia of eating with other people. She would always prefer to eat alone. And of course it never occurred to her the connection between being scolded when she pulled the tablecloth and this apprehension, this low grade fear of being at a table with other people. So these are these what seem like relatively minor events in our lives that really can have a lasting effect. And again, then there are times when we are aroused to respond, we mobilize to respond, and we don't unrespond. We don't return to our equilibrium, to our baseline, so we stayed keyed up, anxious, fretful, hypervigilant. But then there's the times when we're completely overwhelmed, something that has just really destroyed our capacity to adapt and respond, and we're shut down, we're depressed, we have severe panic, we have physical symptoms. And another thing that's been left out in the understanding of trauma are the physical symptoms it produces. But let's just look at what happens in a simple way physically. Something happens out of the blue. It's like we get hit in the gut. It's a shock. Something comes as though it's from the outside and acts upon us. And in that moment, we take a deep breath. Our shoulders go up. Our neck constricts. Our whole body constricts. Or, in the shutdown state, our body collapses. It falls into a heap of helplessness. Our muscles lose their tone. And again, all of these things, Terry, are things that happen inside the body, that go on in the body. And when we work through embodiment, through focusing on what's happening on the body, then people can learn with awareness to let go of some of these holdings. And another thing that happens is when we first, say, we brace against the threat, well, then the bracing itself creates the fear, creates the sense of threat. So we brace even more, which causes more perception of threat. You get the idea. It's a vicious cycle. A vicious cycle. It's a positive feedback loop with negative consequences. So again, a key in working with trauma and understanding what trauma is and how it happens in the body, then we also get keys of how to develop tools to help people work with it in their body. Another thing that was very important in the development of my work was when I started working with people in the 60s and early 70s, I was starting to discover how so many things that we now even wouldn't consider being traumatizing were extremely traumatizing. For example, many children had tonsillectomies or eye surgeries under ether. And this was terrifying, terrifying experiences and left people with lifelong panic attacks and depressions. And again, also the many more ordinary things that happen that also leave people traumatized. But I realized, because I was studying the brain around that time, I was in graduate school at Berkeley in the Department of Medical and Biological Physics, and I also got a degree in psychology around the same time, that animals, that we share the same parts of the brain that respond to trauma, the limbic system, the emotional brain, what you're talking about, the third wave, and the brainstem, the instinctual parts of the brain. We basically have identical brain structures as all the other mammals. And at the same time, I realized that if animals were traumatized on a routine basis, the way we are, the way humans are, they wouldn't survive, and the species wouldn't survive. Because if an animal, let's say a prey animal, loses its edge, it's not going to last very long. And so I reason that there must be something innate in the animal's experience and in our experience that allows us to return to equilibrium after we've been activated in a threatening situation. So I spent many years, well, of course, observing my clients and observing what was going on in their bodies, but also observing videos of animals, particularly of predator-prey encounters. And I started to realize that the same things were going on in animals, normally, naturally, that was going on with my clients when I was able to help them resolve these traumatic experiences. Again, these were involuntary things that go on in the body: shaking, trembling, temperature changes, changes in breathing. Many of these things occurred, as I could see, in animals as well. So I reasoned that we must possess the same innate capacity to rebound, to develop a capacity for resilience. And basically, what I started to realize what I was doing is that I was kind of helping to coach my clients to trust those instincts to heal, those instincts to rebound from overwhelming experience. And so the next 25 years was really an intense development of a methodology that was safe, that would be effective, and that could be taught. And as you mentioned, we have training programs. I think somebody said we have 9,000 trainees worldwide. Now, when I heard that, quite frankly, I was stunned, because in my mind, I'm still at this little treehouse that I had in near outside of Berkeley, California, and once every couple of weeks, a group of people, I don't know, 12, 15 therapists would come, and I would demonstrate what I was learning and try to find a way to explain it, to teach it. So kind of in my mind, that's sort of how I, you know, saw my role. So it was rather astonishing when it dawned on me how much it had expanded. And I think when you're talking about a third wave, I think one of the things that I did, particularly in my first book, Waking the Tiger, was that I gave a voice to a lot of the things that different therapists were discovering, particularly therapists who were interested in the body and interested in how we embody experience, how we embody emotions, how we embody sensations, how even we embody thoughts and cognitions, and how we embody spiritual experience. So anyhow, I hope I'm not wandering too much.
No, that was very interesting. I've heard you say some things there that I haven't heard much before, and I'm glad that this, you know, this insight I had about these three waves resonates for you, because it does seem to me to help frame the significance. You know, there are people who are really getting a lot of benefit out of cortical approaches or limbic or cortical and limbic approaches, and who are kind of groping a little bit as to how to make sense of how to frame the new information coming here. And I think very often people don't realize that certain patterns that trap them are not available to insight or even to a corrective emotional experience, but that the body at a more primitive level needs to unwind a deeper traumatic pattern that's anchored in the brainstem. And that's helped me come to a way of framing and appreciating your work. And what you've just elaborated, I think, helps give us a foundation for a broader conversation about trauma as it lives in everybody's ordinary life. And I think, although, you know, I know that, you know, there are many people who really do have full PTSD in a, you know, very serious way, and somatic experiencing in your work are, you know, huge, important resources. You know, they open a huge door for those people, and therefore it does have significance in that frame. But I'd like to talk more about the way that trauma is a pervasive experience for almost everyone, at least subtle levels, and how appreciating the biological, deeper brainstem levels of how our system becomes traumatized and less able to respond is something that we can all learn from, so that everyone listening to this conversation that we're having can apply and infer something from this understanding that can help them relate more compassionately, accurately, and skillfully to the way these patterns arise in their own experience.
I think a really important thing that happens in work with trauma, effective work with trauma, is that people, well, let me step back one step. When you're talking about the three waves, the first wave is what I would call top-down processing. So you're working with thoughts, with cognition, with insights. It's like the common or the contemporary form of that is CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. And by the way, I'm a fan of things like CBT. I think that's very important. But again, if the nervous system is locked at the level, not even of the emotional brain, but of the reptile brain, of the primitive survival instinctual brain, then this kind of top-down processing is going to be very, very limited. It's not going to be enough trickle down. And so I think effective therapy works in both directions. It works from the bottom up, the sensations bubbling up towards the feelings, and then the insights. I'm thinking of a man I worked with last year. He was a Iraq Marine, and he was blown up by two IEDs. And when I saw him first, it was at a case consultation group in Los Angeles. He was unable to, well, he had been diagnosed with severe PTSD, chronic pain, traumatic brain injury, and Tourette's syndrome. And the Tourette's syndrome, again, you don't normally see Tourette's syndrome appearing out of the blue. And so when I met him and we had our first encounter together, he was unable to make any contact. His body would be convulsing, particularly around the head, neck, shoulder region, face, very similar to what you would see, what you saw with the World War I returning soldiers who were shell-shocked. It's a very similar experience. And of course, he had many, many, many deep emotions of guilt, of grief, of loss, of rage at what he experienced. But the key in working first was with that. I realized in observing that the Tourette syndrome really represented what would be happening if a person was. You know, walking as he was walking on patrol, and then all of a sudden this explosion goes off. And what we'll do is our body will attempt to turn to locate that source of the threat, of the danger, so we can be able to respond to it. But because it happens so fast, the person is unable to really respond before they're blown up in the air, and then, of course, the body goes into a protective flex and response. The head goes into the shoulders, you know, the neck shortens. I call it the turtle response, turtle reaction. And all the muscles in the body contract to protect the person. But because that never got to complete, his body kept replaying that over and over again. And in the first two sessions, just by him being aware of the muscles as they contracted and just before they contracted, he was able to untangle that. And his pain level went down from, I think it was like an 8.5 to a 2 to a 3. And the convulsions stopped. But then I give a, I, not this year, but most years I give a five-day workshop at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur called In an Unspoken Voice, How the Body Heals Trauma. And it allowed him the possibility of working through some of the emotions and then to come to peace with, how to even say, what's the right word for something like this, but to redirect his energies, to channel his rage into healthy aggression, so that he was he took a college course in computer security, and he married, had a child. So if I had tried to work with his emotions or his guilt without dealing with the shock response, it would have been impossible. It would have very likely actually just made things worse. So we have to, because when we're working with trauma, it really occurs at this primitive brainstem body level. We really have to start with the bottom-up wave and then unite that with the top-down wave and the emotional wave. But again, it has to be in the way that the emotions don't reactivate the shock, and that the thoughts don't become obsessive, of self-blame. That what good does it do to be aware that you're, well, it may do some good that your thoughts are continually self-blaming thoughts, but it really doesn't change the thoughts. You know, I think about a person who was raped, and whenever they would go on the streets anywhere near where the rape occurred, they would become fearful. Whenever they were touched by their husband, they recoiled in fear and shut down. And so the therapist explains to this woman that her fear is due to the fact that she had been traumatized. And then the person says, well, that's a relief. But then when it happens again, there's even more self-recrimination. It's self-blame, because if I know why this is happening, then why can't I do something to stop it from happening? So again, that's why we have to work.
Right.
Through.
Yeah. Please continue. I was just murmuring acknowledgement.
Okay. Well, anyhow, that's where insight is limited or can even be counterproductive. So I think maybe this third wave, there's also this fourth wave, which is really for therapists and clients to discover how all of these function together as a unitary brain, you know, a unitary mind. You probably have heard of Paul McLean's triune brain theory.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, evolving from the reptile brain of instinct, sensation, basic bodily homeostasis, the emotional brain, the limbic system, and then the mammalian brain, the neo-mammalian brain, the new mammal primate brain. And when we're whole, all of these parts of the brain are functioning in unison, are functioning together in a cooperative way. So our instincts aren't at battle with our reason. You know, Freud, he came to the conclusion basically that our instincts had to be suppressed. Well, he didn't say suppressed, he said sublimated. But I would say that there's something much grander, that our instincts, those powerful surges of energy, and our feelings and our cognitions could come together. And to me, this is an important thing in wholeness and in spiritual development, is not to deny our instincts, not to make everything our thoughts, but to really have our intense sensations, our feelings, and to be able to observe them. And the thing that happens in trauma is when people are overwhelmed, instead of observing what's going on, they become what's going on. They become fear. They become their rage. And they become their shock. So when we're able to untangle that, I think people start to move towards wholeness, to grow into fruition of their being.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And it seems to me that in a way what you're saying points, you know, in terms of the theme of this series, asking this question, how, you know, exactly can higher consciousness help us rise to this, you know, amazing array of challenges that the species is facing, that it suggests that higher consciousness is a matter of this full integration of all these dimensions of our being, these aspects of our nervous system and brain, and therefore it suggests a model of spirituality that appreciates how spirituality can dissociate us, and that isn't healthy, but that there can be an embodied and integrated spirituality that is partly the synthesis or integration of all these dimensions of our being, and that is what really gives us the ability to respond and relate to one another and perhaps show up as a more fully functional, fully responsive human being and human society.
Yes, I couldn't say it better. I think that, you know, we sometimes split off we say the spirituality is high and the body is low. I mean, we may not do this consciously, but there really is that kind of that implicit understanding that we need to have these positive spiritual experiences. In order to do that, we have to deny our baser instincts and emotions. And again, I think the key is in learning to be able to hold them together. You know, when I first came out to Berkeley, I had a friend, a black friend, and he took me and some other friends to one of these black churches in Oakland, and it was the first time I experienced this kind of religious fever, where people would through the song and the singing and the movement and really involving their bodies. And of course we see this in many other spiritual traditions, in Sufism and in most religions. There is a part, an important part, a critical part, where people use their bodies in different ways, whether it's in chanting or in dancing or in spinning and moving. They all have this component that really would be evoking sensations and feelings which actually were quite uncomfortable, at least until one befriended them. There's an expression of people who have meditated for a long time, and they go to bliss, but they leave out, they do this through denial of the body. And I work with a number of people who have had this what called bliss bypass, and when you leave the body unattended, that vacuum can get filled with all kinds of symptoms. And as you said, spirituality is not about having a dissociated experience. I mean, that's relatively easy to do. You just can take a drug and you have a dissociative experience. It's really to cultivate it again, to appreciate these spiritual experiences, but also to cultivate this unitary, integrated functioning of instincts, emotions, and thoughts. Let's see, there's one other thing I was going to say about that. Well, I slipped my mind here, but it'll maybe come back.
Well, you know, perhaps it had something to do with this other aspect of things, which is, you know, one aspect of what your work brings is a whole armamentarium of therapeutic skills and insights and interventions that enable people to work better when they're working with someone who's you know, where trauma is a real factor. And that, you know, embodies itself in this three-year training program. Now, most of the people listening to this interview are probably not going to take the three-year training program, or in most of them probably won't even go into therapy with a trauma therapist, although some may. And yet everyone listening to this can shift through their exposure to this work in some real way, in their way of relating to themselves and their own trauma, and perhaps appreciating the way that trauma manifests in the people around them. And in that way, perhaps this conversation can contribute to the healing of all of us here and a less traumatized society. And I'm interested in what the, you know, the little insights that might really make a difference in people's lives that seem to you most important to point to.
Yeah, first of all, I would say one of the basic tools or premises of somatic experience is of titration, is to not force ourselves to confront our traumas all at once, but to maybe do that, to maybe to look at some of our traumas actually when we're feeling somewhat better. There are tools, for example, no matter how bad you feel in your body, no matter how bad you feel, there's always some place in your body where you feel less bad, or maybe even something that's calming or even pleasurable. And so a trick that anybody can do, is to then put their focus, their attention on those sensations, those less frightening or more positive sensations, and not to deny the negative sensations, but then to shift back and forth between the more positive and the frightening. So maybe the person feels a warmth and tingling in their hand, and they feel a pressure on their chest. So instead of just focusing on the pressure in the chest or leaving the body entirely, to find that part, the hands, and to feel the tingling, and then as you feel the tingling, to shift back to that feeling of pressure in the chest, and then to shift back to the feeling of tingling in the hand. And usually, when people do that a few times, all of a sudden, to their surprise, the pressure in the chest, the sensation of the tightening in the chest, releases, lets go, and they feel some relief. I think even people, when they are in therapy, I think the most important thing in therapy is at the very beginning to help people develop their own tools that they can use. Actually, that was the idea. I did a book CD for Sounds True. It's called Healing Trauma, a pioneering program for restoring the wisdom of your body. And again, this was to give people exercises, to give people tools that they could use with themselves and with family and with friends. And also I provided some exercises on the CD to guide people. So the other thing that, or the thing I use to explain a little bit of why we do it this way is the myth of Medusa. And Medusa was, you know, the Greek mythological creature with the snakes instead of hair, who would turn people to stone when they looked in her eyes, and she had the eyes of terror. And when anybody would look into her eyes, they would be frozen. And that's what trauma is, right? When we get frozen, when our bodies freeze. And Perseus, who was a young warrior, was asked to slay her because she was destroying people right and left. And like all the statues you see when you're walking around the Parthenon, well, those were live people until Medusa got to them, until they got to Medusa's eyes. So Perseus sought counsel from Athena. And Athena really represents knowledge and wisdom. And she said to Perseus, well, whatever you do, don't look directly into her eyes. And so he left, he thanked her, and he thought, well, what does that mean? How do I not look in her eyes if I'm going to try to cut her head off? And he thought about this, and all of a sudden he realized, well, if I use my shield, you know, the thing that the warriors have on their arms to deflect the sword of their adversary, that he had the idea to look at her reflection, and then he was able to cut off her head. Interesting thing, in the wound, in Greek myth, when, you know, somebody is slain early, you know, act 3, scene 3, act 1, that the next scene, the next act is where the action really happens. And in the wound, two creatures, two mythical entities emerged. One was Pegasus, the winged horse, and the other was Creosor, the warrior with the golden sword. And the image of the horse, which is instinct, which is power, which is the body, and the wing, which is transformation. So holding, again, instinct and the spiritual, that also there are things that we learn from our traumas. There are things that just the fact that people have gotten through their traumas, that says something very powerful about their capacity to find healing, to seek healing. So, again, not to look at trauma directly, but to begin to touch trauma with our bodies, to see what happens when we feel frightened. What actually does that feel like in the body? And that's kind of equivalent to Perseus's shield. Instead of looking right at the trauma, we look at what's going on in our body, and then we work with that in ways that I suggested. Also, after we've found a safer place or a more open place in our body that we can shift back and forth to, then we can discover that the sensation, for example, the sensation in the chest, the tightening in the chest, or the knot in the belly, that when we contact that, it will actually seem to get worse for a moment. That is to say, it will contract even more, but then it starts to open. And we discovered that there's an inherent rhythm between contraction and expansion. So whatever we experience, it feels bad, and then it feels worse. As long as we can observe it in our bodies, then it will then go to the other polarity. It will expand. I call this pendulation. It's a kind of a made-up word. But it describes this critical thing that once people get this, once people are able to utilize this, the trauma loses its grip. They start to get freedom from trauma.
Well, this is stimulating a lot in many people. We're having an awful lot of folks writing in very personal comments. You're really touching on the universal trauma that so many people experience, and I really appreciate your bringing this down to such a practical level. It also seems that that there's a kind of a different kind of compassion, that our compassion flows toward ourselves through all our faculties. Sometimes we have insight and we see ourselves and have a kind of appreciation more cortically for our experience. Sometimes we resonate with it emotionally. But it's almost like the kind of compassion that we might have for our pet or for a wild animal, where the sheer creatureliness of our experience opens our hearts to ourselves, that needs to shift if we're to shift in our relationship to this primitive activation of our nervous system that can capture us so much. And it feels like a profoundly self-intimate thing to open to ourselves in that kind of profound animal, deep instinctual level, and to care for our well-being at that level. And I think that common society doesn't signal us to do that. It's as if we're always supposed to have it together, and we're almost rough on one another and rough on ourselves in this place rather than compassionate. And I wonder if that's one of the things that feels important to you, or one of the outcomes of the insights of your work that might make a difference in your view.
Yeah, I think we're both rough on ourselves, but also profoundly distracted. Our society is profoundly distracted. Our society is based on distraction and advertising. What exposure we get any day of people trying to sell us products, trying to convince us that the way to not feel bad is to buy this, that, or the other thing. With our technology, and technology is fantastic. I mean, I could not have the productivity that I have without the use of technology. It's miraculous. And video editing and working with an editor for my books. And I mean, it's miraculous. It's truly, truly miraculous. But it then becomes a compulsion, an obsession. You see, it's very sad. You see people, children, sitting at a table, and nobody's making any contact with other people, but they're just texting other people, probably texting even themselves. And an important part about healing is community, healing in community, and we're programmed. Just as we're programmed to experience fear from each other, we're also programmed to experience peace from each other. And we do this when we're able to make face-to-face contact. My dear friend Stephen Porges calls this neurologically the social engagement system. So when we are so utterly distracted there were a number of studies done where people were basically put on cold turkey from texting and computers and so forth. I think it was like for 24 hours, and they developed symptoms quite similar to drug withdrawal symptoms. So we have, again, such wonderful things that were never before possible. In terms of technology, but we also have greater temptations to get away from ourselves, to not deal with what's going on, to not be inside, to not come home to our bodies, to our presence, to our being, to our instinctive spiritual selves. So that really is a challenge. That's quite a challenge.
Mm, yeah. And as I feel into the implications of this, that we can all take in, there's an aspect of this whole pattern that feels important to speak to, which is how there's a cycle of trauma that most of the abuse or violence that creates trauma is enacted by people who were themselves traumatized, and that it is in our place of trauma that we're more likely to traumatize others. And most people who have been traumatized inevitably have traumatized others. It's part of their history, and as a kind of guilt that accompanies this awareness, and so this unwinding of this cycle of trauma is not only about we absolutely have to free ourselves from the way that trauma is inhibiting our ability to be fully present, and yet we also have to grant ourselves a kind of forgiveness, and you know, because to the degree that the guilt is looming large, it's almost another source of trauma, and it seems like it tends to bind us, make it harder for us to emerge. I'd love to hear any observations you'd like to add to that.
Yeah, well, that's where we come back to compassion again, isn't it? I think it's in AA. There's an expression: hurt people hurt other people. You know, I had a profound insight or a profound validation. Maybe 15 years ago, 12 years, 15 years ago, I was doing a training in Middle East, and that was before the Intifada. And so we had Israeli and Palestinian therapists together in this training. And one person asked the question, well, can you work with a trauma that the person doesn't know what the trauma is? And I said, yes. All you need to do is have any kind of a symptom, whether it's a pain symptom or any kind of symptom. And so this one person, he's a very, very well-known psychoanalyst. He was a Holocaust survivor and had written several books on psychoanalysis and Holocaust. And so he said, you know, I've had back pain, severe back pain for 30 years. I've never had a day without the pain. And I said, well, we can certainly address that. And he came up, and I had him find the sensations that were underneath the pain. And he experienced a tremendous tension in his lower back. And as we were able to focus on that more with pendulation, he felt his back starting to turn, to twist. And then he felt as though he were falling back, and I put my hand behind his head, and I encouraged him to follow that sensation. And then his whole face just completely broke out in sweat. His hands were sweating. And he started to shake and to tremble. And this went on for waves of this for a good part of an hour. And finally, at the end, he took these deep, spontaneous breaths. Tears were coming from his eyes. And he said that what was happening is he remembered 30 years ago. He was an army doctor, and his battalion, the truck, was ambushed, and everybody was killed except him. And he also witnessed some horrific things. As they came and then they mutilated the bodies, and could see that, of course, everybody was deeply affected. And so I often just, you know, invite people, if it's in a group, if there's something they want to share, what they experienced while the other person was working. And about the third or fourth person to talk was this woman. Remember, she was in a gray suit from Gaza Mental Health, Palestinian woman. Beautiful, elegant woman. And she stood up and she said, you know, Chaim, when you came up to work with Dr. Levine, I prayed that something bad would happen. I prayed that nothing good would come of this, because I hate you. I hate your people. Your people have tortured my people, have humiliated my people, have killed my people. But something happened, and I can't explain it. It just happened inside my body, and I felt deep compassion for you, for me, for all of us. And I realized that until we find peace within ourselves, we'll never find peace with each other. So the profundity of how, you know, how violence perpetuates more violence, and really trauma is the root of how we keep recycling trauma, violence, and pain, even, and physical pain, like with Chaim. Actually, that was motivation, because, again, very common symptom of people with trauma is physical pain. So I did a book called Freedom from Pain, a book CD, again, with my colleague, Maggie Phillips, again, to help people use these same tools to work with pain that might be trauma-related, or actually any chronic pain. That's another thing that's so prevalent, I think it's something like it, right, at any given time, 20 million people in the U.S. are disabled by chronic pain. And so how we can, and how that pain itself can be traumatizing. So it really, trauma becomes like the nexus, the intersection of so many things, of violence, of pain, of mistrust, of distrust. It's I think until we really, really have people have tools to work with this, to help each other with this, and we probably don't have time, but there were, you know, some projects that I was working on with some colleagues to actually to try to reverse these cycles of violence and pain that go on from generation to generation. But again, hopefully not to be redundant, without understanding the role of trauma in the body and the importance of dealing with trauma, but also of appreciating that as we deal with trauma, that we are inherently awakened in a spiritual, compassionate direction, just as this woman who had nothing but hatred towards the Israelis was able to feel this compassion for him, but not only for him, but for the whole situation that they're living in, because hurt people hurt people.
Yeah. Well, Peter, this is opening up so much. There are an awful lot of questions coming in from folks, and I want to turn to them. There are a couple of important announcements first. I want to make sure that everybody knows how to find out more about Peter's work. First, I want to direct you to his books, Waking the Tiger and In an Unspoken Voice. There are others, but those first, which are both available at your local independent bookstore or online on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the other places. You can also go to Peter's personal website, somaticexperiencing.com, and there are a few videos, and you can sign up for his personal mailing list and see his teaching schedule. But there's another larger, more elaborate website, traumahealing.com, which is the website for the whole somatic experiencing community. And you can sign up for a larger somatic experiencing mailing list there and access a wealth of information and resources, including articles and audios and videos and information about the training programs. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Peter?
Sorry. And also therapists, they can get referrals or a list of therapists in their area. So that's another thing they can get from.
Yeah, very importantly, yeah.
Great. You know, another thing, we were talking, is one other thing I wanted to mention. You know, after working with trauma for over 40 years, the last 20 years, I really thought a lot about preventing trauma, particularly in children, children and infants. And because, you know, what a difference it could make if we could resolve these things, heal these things before they became full traumas. And as part of that, my excuse me, my colleague Maggie Klein and I wrote a book called Trauma Proofing Your Kids, A Parent's Guide for Instilling Confidence, Joy, and Resilience. And this is the idea that when we help children learn these tools to be self-empowered, to be confident, to be compassionate human beings, then we'll be building a society based on clear direction, based on compassion, based on the capacity for people to care about each other and to help each other heal. So this has been a really big part of my life in the last couple of decades of providing tools and that parents can use to, when the child has the inevitable fall off the bicycle or crashes through the window or has to have an invasive medical procedure, that the parents have tools to help the children resolve these shock reactions before they become a lifelong traumas. So this is that particular book really gives those basic exercise and skills and games that parents can play with their kids. So
great.
Okay.
Great. I'm glad you presenced that. That's really important. While I'm making announcements, I want to make people aware of some of my own offerings too. And I want to make sure everybody knows about the remarkable gathering of the Integral Evolutionary Tribe that will be taking place at the end of this year over New Year's near Boulder, Colorado, the What Next Conference, which is a worldwide integral conference on the future, and really look at the future of the planet and the future of culture and consciousness, and engage one another co-creatively in a series of remarkable conversations. It'll culminate in a historical occasion in which those of us who have been most deeply influenced by Ken Wilber's integral vision will gather together with him and tell him what that's meant to us and offer him a tribute. Really, this has never happened before. And among the remarkable people who are gathering for this occasion are Diane Hamilton, Jeff Salzman, Sean Yesborn Hargens, Helen Palmer, Barrett Brown, Decker Kunoff, Samuel and Linda Bonder, many others. It's December 28th through January 1st. And you can find out more about it by going to whatnextintegral.com. If you want to register, you can mention my name and be eligible for a discount off your registration fee. So please do that. You can also connect with me and my work by signing up for my mailing list, which is different from the Beyond Awakening list, by visiting my website, which is changed now. It's terrypatton.com. And there are thoughtful emails and a whole range of things that you may not be getting now. So I invite you to do that. There's also a free guided meditation that I'll send you if you do. Please stay on the line. At the end of the call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up in with our upcoming guests in a little less than 4 weeks on Thursday, December 6th in the evening, not at our usual time. I'll be having a conversation with the remarkable eco-psychologist and Buddhist teacher Joanna Macy. So please stay tuned for more about that. To ask questions, press star 2 on your telephone keypad, and you can ask a question in your live voice. And those of you on the computer see the opportunities to type the type questions in. We have quite a few questions. I want to apologize right up front that we can't answer anything close to all of them, and there are a lot of really good ones. But let me lead off with a very poignant one, kind of a deep one from somebody who's already working with a somatic experiencing therapist. Karen in Juneau says, I grew up in a violent home and was raped at age 18. Was my first sexual experience, and I've suffered from severe depression, PTSD, and panic disorder for 2 decades now. I've been working with an SE practitioner for nearly 2 years, and I'm just now able to be in my body to an extent I never have before. I'm making progress, slowly. One of the very difficult situations I've been having in the past 6 months or so is waking up each morning to a severe state of panic and terror. I can't begin to explain how terrifying this feeling is just upon coming into consciousness. It's as if the moment I reawaken my awareness from sleep, a sensation of something awful about to happen absolutely overwhelms me. At that time, no images or memories are present, just a paralyzing and absolute terror. I've found nothing that works to lessen this sensation, meditation, walking outside, deep breathing, etc. All I can do is wait it out. After a few hours, it slowly subsides, but it's an awful way to start each day. Can you suggest what may be happening and what I can do to relieve this terrifying feeling upon awakening? Why is this so severe and incapacitating upon waking from sleep? How can it just appear so powerfully and seemingly out of nowhere when I know logically there is no danger present? Thanks so much, Peter. Your work is helping me to heal, but I think I might be missing something.
Well, you know, actually, during the night, that's the time that our demons choose to visit us. And I think in a way, you know, the observing parts of our brain are not online. So really, when we're asleep, we are kind of asleep in an instinctual world, a primitive world. And what I would suggest, for example, you might instead of focusing on this terror, is to find one part of your body, maybe your hand, and just put all your awareness on your hand, and then closing your hand into a fist slowly, and then slowly opening it. So in other words, you're able to just focus on one part of your body that at least is more neutral, and by very slowly closing and opening the hand, you may discover that you start to be able to observe that even these horrible sensations also get less and more and less and more, that there's a rhythm to that. And so the worst terror of all is to feel completely stuck. So if you can find some movement anywhere in your body, that can begin to help take you out of the stuck place. And, you know, when you're raised in an environment of violence and threat, it's like being in a war zone. I mean, it is being in a war zone. Like your nervous system is being constantly jangled. And then you have these, in addition, these horrible traumas, like a trauma of rape, incest and rape. This is, you know, again, the body just has no way to make sense of this. But you are finding, you know, in your therapy, you know, and when somebody has had a life incubated in terror and violence and trauma, there are no shortcuts. It's a slow process. A lot of times people say, okay, well, because they know people who have done somatic experiencing, and they get rid of symptoms in a very few sessions, in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sessions. But when you're working with that corrosive, ongoing violence, incubated trauma, it's a miracle. The healing is a miracle, but it's a hard work miracle. It can be a slow miracle. And the fact that you've been able to be in your body instead of that body being your complete enemy shows that you really are beginning to transform your traumatic history. And again, I would just suggest more awareness, more exercises of the parts of your body where you can feel some okayness or some neutrality, and that you can begin to give the rest of your body the idea that it is in a state of contraction and expansion. It's not just contraction. It's not just dissociation. And the fact that you're able to stay with your body, even with the terror, and not dissociate, speaks really to your developing capacity to heal these horrible events. Heal from these horrible events. So I'm just really glad that you found someone that you can work with, and I wish you continued deep healing.
Thank you, Peter. I want to take a live caller. We have a caller whose phone caller ID lists Cynthia Shell in Seattle, Washington. Just a moment. We have a little technical glitch in my opening her line. Brad, can you do that for me? Cynthia, are you? Good,
I'm here.
We can hear you. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a nurse, and I recently taken a position triaging patients after they've had major chest and abdominal surgery, and I'm starting to see a personality constellations with patients that are having a lot of postoperative symptom management issues. And my sense is that there's some underlying childhood trauma. So my question is twofold. One is, what can I do to support them in their recovery experience, given the fact that I'm not a therapist and I'm having limited contact with them? And then the second question is there a tool or any studies that are looking at that you could direct me to? Because I have a feeling that this group of physicians might be open to looking at this a little more deeply.
Wow, Cynthia, you have actually just talked to another area that is really, really important to me. We're working with traumatized people for all these times. I've noted that some of the source of some of the deepest, most pervasive traumas are things that happen while their lives are being saved because of medical procedures, invasive and terrifying medical procedures. I've done a lot of grand rounds and so forth for hospitals to try to help people, it's mostly nurses that are interested, to provide simple tools that they can use to help the patients not become traumatized or to move through that trauma. So one of the things is that a patient, whenever possible, should never go into under general anesthesia while they're frightened.
Thank you.
Whatever you can do to help calm them, to let them know that you're there, that they're going to be taken care of, be okay. That can make all the difference in the world. Truly all the difference in the world. Another thing that, and this is especially true of children, but I'd like to see this with everybody. Nobody should wake up in the recovery room alone. There should always be somebody, a nurse or a social worker, to make contact with them to tell them that they're coming out of the anesthesia, the surgery, if the surgery went well, to tell them the surgery went well, and then so they have something to orient to. Because otherwise, you're in this room, and again, this is especially true with children. People are moaning. You're seeing, there are these sounds from the different monitors, the different electronic sounds. And people are walking around, with masks. And for children, these look like demons. And no contact is made. When the person is coming out, if somebody like you went over to them and gently say, touch their wrist, their arm, and said, yeah, hi, my name is Cynthia. I'm the nurse here. I just want you to know that the surgery went well. You'll be feeling disoriented for a while, but that will wear off, you see. So they know that what they're experiencing is time-limited. Cynthia, as a nurse, you can make such a difference. one of the things I'm hoping to do is to do some presentations. I've just not been able to schedule it with some of the national nurse organizations to talk about these kinds of things. But that you want to do something, you can. You can do something. If you want, also, there was a number of interesting studies done of people who were in ICU for as little time as a week, you know, when they're particularly when they're on ventilators, and a large percentage of them develop severely debilitating symptoms. They lose all their strength. They develop symptoms of PTSD. And this is a multi-site study. You can probably Google it. I have it on one of my PowerPoint things, so I don't have right access to it now. But you can probably just Google, you know, debilitating symptoms occurring in the aftermath of ICU. And I think there were at least three or four hospitals, medical centers, university medical center hospitals, where these studies were done. It's really alarming. And again, there are things that could be done to help people recover their strength and restore their natural organic breathing rhythm, which when you lose that, you completely disintegrate.
Thank you so much.
Sure. So good luck. And I thank you for calling. I'm really hope that you'll, you know, share this kind of information with all of your colleagues, because you can make a really big difference in people's lives.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. Okay. We have so many touching questions. I'm going to choose a couple from a woman named Wendy from the Bronx. She writes, can a relationship leave a person traumatized? I feel so. Although I've been free from the relationship for several months, no one realized I didn't cause chaos, lies, deception, etc. I do realize how my reactions to those behaviors have contributed to the relationship's demise. And I feel compelled to apologize to this person, despite my overall feelings of innocence. This is because I want to be free from the guilt I'm holding for my behaviors and actions. I should have walked away long ago. Now I'm left confused about whether apologizing is necessary or will be received in the spirit I intended. Then there's fear of this move on my part being misinterpreted and or used against me. I don't expect a reciprocal apology, but I want to become the type of person I long to one day find, one with a conscience compelled to apologize when necessary, etc. I'm unsure if my feelings are an awakening on my part or just a result of being stuck in the past. And then Wendy went on to say, you know, when you mentioned about how one meditates, they must be mindful not to abandon the body, that feels so right on. I've been participating in a 21-day meditation challenge by Deepak Chopra. And while I've been enjoying the calm bliss it's brought me, I've been concerned that the practice has positioned me to ignore the pain I've been feeling from the earlier mentioned breakup. I've also been having storm dreams lately, tornadoes, hurricanes, and so forth, which has made me wonder and question if I'm actually healing from the year-long chaotic deception I endured.
Wow. Well, Wendy. By the way, I'm from the Bronx. I was born in the Bronx. So I really, hi, fellow Bronxer. You know, I think the only person you have to apologize to, really, by the way, a lot of things that you're talking about are quite mature. They're really quite grown up, mature, self-reflective, self-aware perceptions. I think the only person you have to apologize to, though, really, is yourself, have been so hard on yourself. And I also want to recognize your willingness to look at your part, because very often, you know, when there's betrayal, of whether it's cheating or, you know, many, many different other forms of betrayal, the one person is obviously the perpetrator, and then we're the victim. But that's only one side of it, because relationships are more complicated than that. Relationships are really, really complicated. And we, at an unconscious level, we always are redoing our you know, the unfinished stuff from our past, from our childhood. We're reflecting them on the other people. You know, it's like many of us carry around a script for a play, a drama that we are always continually imposing on different situations. It's like we're a film director casting, and the people we encounter into these different roles that we need in order to replay the same script over and over again. So these moods and emotional scripts cause us to misinterpret the world and misinterpret each other in a relationship. So it's really complicated, and it takes a commitment, I think a very, very deep commitment, for people who are in relationships to be able to say, look, you know, I want to take responsibility for my past. I want to use the relationship as an opportunity to help get past my past. But it takes two people to commit it to that, and it takes an honesty, and it takes a willingness to help for people to create enough safety with each other so that can begin. And you know, if there's some really breach in the relationship, that safety has to be repaired first. So I think again, the important thing is you're forgiving of yourself, not really apologize, but forgiving of yourself for not having had all the tools to be fully awakened, right? Which, of course, is what we all, the compassion we always have to have, or we can always use for ourselves, because we're doing the best we could. You are doing the best you could. You're doing your relationship partner at the time was probably doing the best he or she could do under the circumstances. But if both people aren't committed to healing the past through the relationship, then you did what you needed to do, which is to leave. And you could look at one side, well, did I stay too long, or should I work more? So either way you look at it, you can always criticize yourself. So I think the important thing is to know that you did the right thing, and that you have compassion for yourself. I guess you had a second question here, I think, about meditation. I think I mentioned this briefly before, it's kind of this bliss bypass that when we, you know, we can use these beatific states, these blissful states to avoid feeling in our bodies. I think that can become problematic. But just having a positive experience, then you can take it the next step and say, okay, what's going on in my body while I'm having this beatific experience, while I'm having this peaceful experience. So I hope I've answered your question in some ways. But again, I think the important thing is that you really are conscious and you really want to untangle from the what Carl Jung called the complexes, the things from our past that we're constantly drawn to and what we create in our present situations, and to really look for a next relationship where you're having more of that reciprocity, more of that mutual respect, and you know, and just to let go, to see where you're holding on and where you're letting go of the relationship. You know, because attachment is critical. As infants, you know, we attach to our parents, and we would die without our parents. We would die, literally. A baby dies if it doesn't have a caregiver. And so we still have that same fear that if we lose a relationship, we'll die. I mean, it feels like that. The feelings feel so horrible that we'll die. So you've had the courage to face that, and now you can take next steps. I hope that's helpful, Wendy.
Thank you, Peter. That was very rich. You know, there's a question here that's arisen that takes us in a little bit of a different direction that I think might be helpful to a lot of people, which is what are some of the different ways that you've seen trauma affecting sexual responsiveness and sexual behavior?
Oh, gosh. Any trauma of any kind affects our sexual openness, our sexual responsiveness, our sexual compulsivity. That was another one, by the way, because I realized that not just people who are traumatized because of sexual molestation, incest, things like that, but in general trauma reduces our capacity to be with ourselves sexually. And, of course, no more is that sacred wound when we have been violated sexually. And that was another CD I did for Sounds True called, what is it called, Sexual Healing, to reclaim our sexual feelings, because these, again, are these instinctual. They're way, way beyond the, you know, our conscious states. That's not the right way to say it. That sexuality is a tremendous gift. It's a way of deepening connection. It's a way of opening more deeply to ourselves as well as to the other. And if I work with somebody who has had sexual abuse, for example, I wouldn't consider the work successful unless the person really had not just the symptoms of their trauma removed or reduced, but their capacity for sexual fulfillment being supported. I'm not saying this well. Many of us, maybe even most of us, both put too much in sexuality and too little in sexuality. You know, we sort of, it's like we don't have a good feeling with ourselves and a comfortable relationship with other friends and intimate relationship. And so we put everything on sex. Or we just, sex is though it's a casual thing. It's very sad. I mean, when I grew up in the 50s in New York, in the Bronx, only bad girls, I mean, whores, would have sex. And there was a kind of a strangulation, an orexia around sexuality. And now I see with great deal of sadness, I see young kids, I mean, some kids as young as 10 years old or younger, having this, it's not even beyond casual sex. I mean, they're just giving the older boys oral sex. There's connection. The adolescent awakening is a time of spiritual awakening, adolescent awakening to sexuality. These powerful, powerful impulses, but also these ways of deepening our emotionality. It's overwhelming for kids, for adolescents, And so we don't get the experience of the sacredness of sexuality. So I think that's really important. That's something that it's a gift to restore that wonder, that openness, that innocence around sexuality, and also developing a capacity for deep sexuality. Because, I mean, over the years, I've worked with a lot of people with so-called sexual dysfunction. And so, and there are things that are mostly around embodiment that the way I work with it, at least over the years, both with my clients and with myself, is to get through compassion, self-compassion, to touch the fears that are evoked in sexuality and be able to be open and share them with my lover, so that they lose their bite, so that I'm able to open and have a larger experience and to not be frightened of that, to share that together, to welcome that. And it is. Sexuality, deep sexuality is scary. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, as societies, we've avoided it either by prohibition or by a different kind of sacrilege, by the callous casualness of sex. So I think I'm going around in circles here, but that's,
no, those were very, very important and very compassionate and deeply felt words, Peter. I really appreciate all the different places we've gone. And I can see by the comments that those who are participating in this conversation with us have really been deeply touched and opened in a compassionate way to the incredible vulnerability and resilience of our bodies and of our, you know, how trauma is a fact of our lives, and maybe even an opening through which we can become more profoundly whole than we might have even been without that journey through it.
Yeah.
So I'm really touched. Is there anything that you'd like to say, kind of concluding to everyone? We're really out of time now, but I want to, you know, we have a few things. I want to open up the line so everyone can say goodbye. But before all that, is there anything you'd like to say now?
Well, I would say, first of all, trauma is a fact of life, but it doesn't have to be a life sentence. Not only that, being able to begin to work with our traumas can be a portal into spiritual experience and to spiritual practice. Thank you. Thank you all for listening and for the wonderful, really wonderful, open, intelligent questions that you've asked.
Thank you, Peter. Well, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by telling others about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested in learning more about Peter Levine, please access his books, visit somaticexperiencing.com, his personal website, and traumahealing.com, where you can contact a somatic experiencing therapist in your area. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to look to get on my personal mailing list and find out about my work. And then about what's coming up. I mentioned that I'll be speaking with Joanna Macy. She's really a remarkable and pioneering and very deep Buddhist eco-philosopher. She's the developer of what she calls the work that reconnects and author of The Great Turning. And then early next year, January 13th, I'll be talking with the remarkable science journalist Lynn McTaggart, the author of the best-selling books The Field, The Bond, and The Intention Experiment. Thank you so much for joining Peter and me today. Let's open up our line so we can, those of us on the phone, can hear each other's voices and say goodbye. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Blessings.